I'm excited to dive into the learning with you. So the learning we're going to be looking at today as we are, we're getting closer. We're approaching the holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And these are holidays that perhaps sometimes we approach with some sense of trepidation, some sense of fear and anxiety of, have we made the apologies we need to make? Are we in the right emotional state? But overall, I think there's a lot of joy and hope that oftentimes accompanies Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah, a holiday, the liturgy, that one of the lines we come back to in the liturgy over and over on Rosh Hashanah, Hayom Harat Olam. Today is the conception. It's the birth of the world. It's the day that the world is coming into being. It's a holiday that I think for many of us symbolizes hope. It symbolizes new beginnings, possibilities, and growth. It's really a holiday of not only do we get to start over, but we imagine it's as if the whole world is starting over. And we can ask ourselves normally the question on Rosh Hashanah, what are the new possibilities that await us this year? What is going to be born and brought into fruition? Yom Kippur is said to be, surprisingly perhaps, but it's said to be one of the two most joyful days of the year. Perhaps something as we're fasting we don't normally concentrate on. You could ask yourself, why do the rabbis conceive of Yom Kippur as being one of the joyous days of the year? And one answer is that on Yom Kippur, we have the possibility to start over. Again, like Rosh Hashanah, we have the possibility to be totally wiped clean of that moment after you, and I do feel this myself, that moment when you say the Mariv, the first Mariv, the first evening davening after Yom Kippur, when you say the Amidah for that first time after standing and davening all day, and you knock your chest and say, forgive us, we have sinned. And it's a moment of, but actually at this moment, I maybe yet haven't sinned, right? That there's this moment of Yom Kippur, that extreme joy of actually being made clean, of actually being made whole, and having this one chance, you have this like 1 second to start over totally anew before you fall back into the year and all into your old patterns. And so just in general, when we generally think about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, at least I approach them with a certain sense of hope and joy, not to mention all the gathering and the family meals and coming together people. We're not quite in the same place this year, needless to say. We're in a moment where a lot of us in our personal lives and in our communal lives and globally are experiencing a lot of loss, a lot of sadness, and a lot of brokenness, and both losses that are very tangible losses, the very tangible loss of life, the very tangible loss of jobs and any sense of security. And then there are also the less tangible losses that are very real nonetheless, which is a loss of sort of any sense of security, sort of a newfound sense of frailty, the loss of what it means to be able to be in physical, intimate relationships with people that we might have taken for granted. So the two questions that I'm asking myself this year and that I want to think about together are these. As we're going to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, one, how do we lean into that sense of hope and growth that we associate with Rosh Hashanah in a moment of continued loss? And two, how do we find joy in a moment of sadness and brokenness? How do we lean into the hope of Rosh Hashanah, the sense of growth, while we are still in a period of loss? And how do we find joy in a moment of sadness and brokenness? And we're going to look at these questions by turning to none other than Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. Rabbi Nachman is a figure sort of larger than life, considering we only had him in this world for 39 years. But in his 39 years, he just brought so much Torah. And a lot of his Torah is a Torah, sort of a Torah of opposites, a Torah of contradictions, a Torah of finding joy in sadness, of finding faith in doubt, of finding light in darkness. And really in many ways, a figure of resilience in his own life. And so he makes sense as a person that we're going to turn to. So just to give you a little bit of a background on Rabbi Nachman and his life before we actually dive into his Torah. So Rabbi Nachman was born in 1772. He was born in Uman in the Ukraine, and he is the founder of Breslov Chassidut, Rabbi Nachman was the great grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, sort of the founder of Chassidut. So he has that lineage. Rabbi Nachman was married early. He had six daughters. He had six daughters and two sons. And he also suffered great personal tragedy in terms of a person who is speaking from firsthand experience about what it means to experience darkness, what it means to experience really very real depression and very real despair. Of his six daughters and his two sons, two of his daughters died in infancy, and two of his sons died as toddlers. So the death of four of his children very young. His wife died in, I think, 1808. And Rabbi Nachman ended up dying, succumbing to tuberculosis in 1810. So just in general, there was a lot of death in his life and a lot of sickness in his life. And then on top of that, Rabbi Nachman was also a figure that was plagued by a lot of controversy. There was a lot of bitterness and controversy between him and another rabbi of the time. And that sort of same controversy followed to his student, Rabbi Nathan, who also became embroiled and was the subject of a lot of attack. So not only sort of the loss of a life, but also a life that was sort of mired in controversy, that was mired in struggle. And yet it was in this struggle that he continues to write about faith, that he continues to write about joy, that he continues to write about light. And so that's why we're going to turn to him to see how do we do it? What's the pathway forward when darkness and despair is very real, when loss of hope is very real? How do we find that in ourselves? There's just sort of one more piece of Torah that I want to give you by way of intro before we see the text. If you're interested in getting more into Chassidut, or if you're already into Chassidut, there's an amazing podcast by Rabbi Joey Rosenfeld. The podcast is called Inward Looking. He brings all sorts of different Torah by Hasidic rabbis and thinkers, and he has a whole set of podcasts on Rabbi Nachman. And he teaches Rabbi Nachman that there are two key words that appear in Rabbi Nachman all the time in his teachings: afal pi chen, nevertheless, afal pi chen, and daika. Daika is sort of connected to the word that we might be more familiar with, dafka, which is so hard to translate, but it's like daika, dafka, specifically in that thing. And what he says about that, he says that those words, afal pi chen, nevertheless, and daika, appear all the time, very often in Rabbi Nachman's Torah. But afal pi chen, meaning that you might think that it wouldn't be possible. You might think that why wouldn't be possible, but nevertheless, even so, you're able to find it, right? You might think that in a moment of darkness, you wouldn't be able to find light, but nevertheless, you were able to find light. So that's that his Torah of contradictions, that even though you might think that through sort of a lack of hope or despair, you couldn't find joy, nevertheless, you're able to come to it. So that Torah of surprising you, of upending expectations. Daika is even stronger than that. Nevertheless, it's like, even so, you somehow are able to make it through. Daika is actually the way to the light. The way to the hope is daika, is through that despair, is through that darkness, that we would never think that darkness could take us to a place of joy. But daika, it's actually, we think that we have to run from it, but actually we have to go towards it, because that's going to be the thing that takes us towards that joy. So I just think that's good framing for Rabbi Nachman's Torah in general, of how he's able to hold faith and doubt, how he's able to hold joy and darkness, and that actually sometimes it is through the doubt, it is through the darkness that we're able to find our way forward. Okay, that was by all means of an intro. And just the final last thing, if you'll permit me to say, Rabbi Nachman had a piece of Torah. His great wish is that from all of his Torah, we would take them and we would make into them prayers. That Torah shouldn't be just sort of an intellectual study that we learn and it's nice and then we leave the source sheet somewhere, but that actually the aim of Torah is to internalize it so deeply and to sit with it that we can make it into a prayer that stays with us and goes beyond our learning. And so I'll just put that as something in your mind that I'm going to reserve a couple of minutes at the end to ask you, what is the prayer you would take from this Torah? That's really the ultimate goal. Not that this should stay a heady intellectual experience, but that we should be able to internalize it and come away with a personal prayer for ourselves. So this first teaching comes from Likutei Moharan. This is really all of Rabbi Nachman's works were given over and written down by his dedicated, faithful student, Rabbi Nathan. That it's thanks to him that we have all these teachings. So this is through Rabbi Natan giving over Rabbi Nachman's Torah. So he says, Diberi manu kama pami me'inyan yisore olam hazeh. So Rabbi Natan says, Rabbi Nachman spoke with us several times about the matter of the suffering, the pain of the world. Shekol b'nei ha'olam kulam le'im yisorim. Because all people of the world are full of suffering. It's just a fact, he says, that everyone is full of suffering. Ein gam echad shiyelo olam hazeh. This is a puzzling line that I want to come back to, and I'm going to ask you specifically about in the chat how you understand this. And there is no one in this, there is no one that has this world, that there is to him haolam hazeh, okay? He's going to come back to that line, and I want to come back to that line. What does it mean? Everyone is full of suffering, and there is no one that has haolam hazeh. There's no one that has this world. Ve'afilu ha'ashirim ha'gedolim ve'afilu ha'tzarim en lehem shum olam hazeh klal. Even sort of the rich great ones or the important officers, none of them have olam hazeh klal. None of them have this world. Ki kol yemehim ka'as u'machavot, because all their days are full of anger and pain. Ve'chulam le'im tradot u'da'agot ve'atvut. And they're all full of these worries and the sadness and the sighing all of the time. And to every person, there are individual sufferings. I think this is an important line. Sometimes, you know, we say, even in this moment of COVID, we say, well, we're all experiencing the same thing. And then the response to that is actually, we're not all experiencing this the same way. We're all experiencing this in very different ways. That there's a call out here that on one hand, Rabbi Nachman is saying, suffering is a universal thing, that every single person, it doesn't matter how much money they have, how important they are, what their status is, everyone experiences suffering. That is a fact, it's universal. And at the same time, we have to remember that suffering is unique to each person, and that the sufferings a person has, we can't make assumptions about, oh, well, I understand your suffering, or you, or we're experiencing the same thing, that actually each person's sufferings are unique to them. The kol echad yesh lo yisurim miyuchadim, these unique sufferings. Ve'en gam echad mikol ha'gvirim ve'asirim shiyelo hakol keseder kirtzono tamid. And there's no one from all the powerful people, from all the offers, that has everything go according to their will all the time. Ve'kulam ke'echad mle'im yisirim u'da'agot tamim. Again, he says it's universal suffering. He says everyone is as one. They are full of suffering and worries always. It's a powerful idea. What are the things that we're so different as people? What is the thing that unites us? He's saying the thing that unites us, actually, the thing that makes us one, is the fact of suffering. He says, and this is clear and known to anyone who's just a bit experienced in this and in their ways. He goes on to say, so he answered our Rebbe. So Rabbi Natan, again, he's saying, Rabbi Nachman, he answered and he said, may his memory be a blessing. Hine hakol omrim, everyone says, sheyesh olam hazeh ve'olam haba. Everyone says there's two worlds. There's this world and there's the world to come. Ve'hine olam haba, anu ma'aminim sheyesh olam haba. And the world to come, we believe, we have faith that there is the world to come. Efshar yesh gam olam hazeh gam ken be'ez olam. And it's possible that there's also this world in some universe, in some world. Ki bekan nir'eh shehu gehenom. But here, he's saying here, when I look around, I just see gehenom. I just see sort of a living hell. I don't actually see this world. He's saying, that everyone says there's two worlds. Everyone says there's a world to come and there's this world. And he's saying something that's inverse, counterintuitive. Normally would say, well, this world that I see, I believe, it's the world to come that I'm not so sure I believe, that I don't know what that's going to be like. For Rabbi Nachman, that's not the case. He says, the world to come, that I believe in, that I have confidence in, I know that that's going to be, it's actually this world that I'm not so sure about. Perhaps this world exists in some universe, but when I look around at this world, when I look around myself, all I see is Gehinom. All I see is suffering. Ki kulam le'im yisorim gedolim tamid. Because everyone is suffering these great sufferings always. The Amar, and he would say, she'ein nimsa shum olam hazeh klal. That this world doesn't exist at all. that there are these two worlds, Olam Haba, the world we can't see, that's the world we believe in, but it's actually this world. It's this world when we look around and we just see suffering, that's the world. That's the world that I'm not sure about. This is the world that the world doesn't exist at all. I want to turn to you and I want to hear your thoughts. Specifically, I want to hear your thoughts and responses to this, and also how you understand this phrase. What does he mean when he says that it doesn't matter how much money or how important people don't have this world? And here at the end, he says, "She'ein nimsa shum olam hazeh." This world doesn't exist at all. I want to hear your thoughts on that. I just want to underscore, you know, Rabbi Nachman is not going to leave us there, I promise. It's not going to be the end of the shiur, the end of the class, but how powerful it is for a rabbi of such deep faith to say something like this, to say, actually, the world is suffering. Everyone around me is suffering. And when I look out at the world, I'm not even sure that this world really exists. Just to pause for a second and allow that statement to sit there. Okay, it looks like Hannah has her hand up.
This is one text I think we really all need. So you definitely answered a call. I was seeing this as that this world is kind of a world of objectivity, because this idea that when you're suffering, you're stuck inside your own, you know, your own Dalet Amos, right? You're inside your own head. And so there is no this world, because all of it is your own abstraction. So the idea that you can believe in the next world, because that's the world of your imagination. But when, you know, there's that function of being depressed is being unable to be objective. It's constantly this self-referential thing. So that's the way that I took that, as this world being the world of experience, and the other world being the world of kind of, you know, like draining, you know.
I appreciate that. Okay. Thank you, Hannah, for that. Thank you for helping make sense of that. Yeah. So Ron is saying, maybe it means that there's no real fairness or justice in this world. That when you look around and you see the suffering, that what it means that there's no olam hazeh, that there's no fairness or justice in this world. Rebecca says, extreme suffering and pain does take a person away from experience good things in the world. Yeah, so that feels like it's a little bit in line with what Hannah was saying, that the way in which sometimes when we're so deep in our own pain and suffering, and I think Rabbi Nachman is saying very real pain, like legitimate pain and suffering, that sometimes when we are so deep in our own pain and suffering, it actually takes us out of experiencing this world, or we experience this world, as Hannah was saying, sort of as an abstraction, we're not in the world, we're not able to experience the good things. Thank you, Rebecca, I appreciate that. Faith says, perhaps it means it only exists in our own reality. We can transform our inner reality. That the world only exists, that the Olam Hazeh means the world doesn't sort of exist outside of us, but exists only within us, and we can transform that. Aviva says, is he saying this world doesn't exist, or more like this world has suffering? Yeah, Aviva, it's hard to say. I mean, I do think that what he's saying is, Or like perhaps another way that I think about it is, I don't know if he's going so far as to say this, but almost like the world as I understand it, the world as I was promised, the world as I hope to recognize it doesn't exist. Because when I look around, that world that I imagined or the world that I thought I understood, all I see is suffering. So there's a sense in which the world that I thought was there is not there. Bachi and then Marcia.
I'm wondering whether he is trying to contrast, like he's setting up a different goal than we might think. Like, I feel like a standard position might be that, like, oh, we're in Olam Hazeh. Oh man, this world sucks so much. It's not Olam Haba. Like, that's where we want to get. We should be striving for that world, or like looking forward to that. That's the most beautiful place to be. And he might be saying, like, I think I'm thinking about this in terms of mindfulness. And it's similar to what others have said before, that like, No, like Olam Hazeh would be a great place to be. Like if we could just be in this world, like that would be amazing. Like what sucks is that we're stuck in all the suffering and pain and misery. But if we could just be present in this moment, in this reality, like actual reality of Olam Hazeh, like that would be amazing. He's not, I wonder if he's not actually negating Olam Hazeh. He's just, by saying there isn't Olam Hazeh, he's reorienting our goals. Like, we should try to be in Olam Hazeh, not like try and leave this world. Chas v'shalom, we should try to leave this world.
Amazing. And so then part of the question, I think this goes back to what someone else was saying in the chat, then what does it mean? If that is the goal, to try to be in Olam Hazeh, then what is that goal about? You know, presumably it's about sort of being able to enter into relationships with other people, being able to also experience the joy with the suffering. But we could begin to have a real conversation. What does it mean to, if that's the goal, to be in the Olam Hazeh, which, what an amazing goal for the new year, to try to be in this world, what would that mean to us? Okay, Marcia.
It makes me feel that the world that we experience is insignificant if it's not real, and that of the world to come, which we believe in, will be better. It just makes everything that we experience as suffering, whatever, misfortune, it's insignificant compared to that. And it just puts everything into perspective.
I appreciate that, Marcia, that having the awareness of this other world perhaps puts our own experiences in perspective. At the same time, part of what I appreciate, at least about this Torah Rabbi Nachman for me, is it feels like it's a real acknowledgement and legitimization of people's suffering and pain. That I think that there could be, that it's both ways, that you could say, well, the pain in this world is nothing. Your personal suffering is nothing. You know, there's the world to come. But part of what I appreciate here is he's actually naming suffering is real and pain is real. And it's legitimate. And then the question is, well, what do we do that? How do we be present in this world? How do we, because he's not going to leave us there. We can't stay in that. How do we go from there? And so the question is, as we were saying with Marcia, so that on one hand, there's the naming of suffering, the naming of pain, this profound statement, that this world doesn't exist at all, or at least the world that I know it, the world I expected, were to be so deep in the suffering that you can't experience the world, but Rabbi Nachman is not going to leave us there. So we're going to look at the second text. This is a very famous piece by Rabbi Nachman. He says, "V'ha'ikar," also from Nikutei Moharan, he says, "V'ha'ikar, the essence, l'chazek atzmo b'kol ma she'efshar," that a person has to strengthen themselves in any way possible with whatever means they're able to, right? You have to do anything you can. "U'mashach me'od elu atevot kain ye'ush," and to really draw, and when he would say that there is no despair in the world, he would draw out the words, there is no despair. Ve'amaram be'koach gadol uve'amkut nifla ve'nura me'od, and he would say them with great strength and with sort of amazing depth, the way he would say this, that Rabbi Nachman is teaching that you have to strengthen yourself in all ways possible. And he would draw out the words he would say, because there is no such thing as despair in this world. There is no such thing as despair. Kedei lehorot uleramez lekol echad ve'echad ledorot shelo yitya'esh b'shum ofen ba'olam, in order to teach and to sort of hint to everyone in all future generations that they should not give up in any way, b'shum ofen ba'olam, in any way in this world. Afilu im yavor lav ma, ve'echshu afilu im nafal l'mekom shenafal, even if whatever comes upon a person, whatever hardness comes upon a person, in whatever way, even a person falls, whatever place they fall, rachman lislan, may God save them, me'echar she mechazek atzmo b'mashehu, after a person strengthens themselves in whatever, by whatever they have, adayin yesh lo tikva lashuv ve'lachzor alav yitvorach, still that person has hope to return to the Holy One. And so he's saying, you know, it's balancing with these other texts. On the one hand, you have this Torah in that first piece that names so plainly, when I look around, I see the one thing that is universal is suffering. I see people are full of despair all the time, that this is that there's such an extent that it's as if this world doesn't exist. And then he says, there is no such thing as despair in this world. It is forbidden to give into despair, right? That you have to do whatever you can to strengthen yourself so that there's some sort of hope of returning, to not get so distant, of returning to God. And so he's holding those two things. On one hand, he's giving us, I think, the legitimization, the permission to name the reality of pain. And he's also saying, you can't give into the pain. And he actually says it in two different ways in this piece. I haven't given you the full text. On one hand, he says, there is no such thing it doesn't exist at all. There's no such thing as despair, which is sort of feels so contrary to the first piece where he names everyone has so much despair. And on the other hand, and in another sentence later, he says, it's forbidden to give in to despair. So it's like there's two different ways. On one hand, do you refuse to acknowledge that despair exists? You can't even, so dark, you can't even go there. You have to stay above it. On the other hand, he acknowledges that despair exists. He legitimizes it. He says that everyone is suffering. He says, but you actually can't give into it. There's no such thing as despair, or you can't give into it. I want to read one more text together, and then I'm going to pause, and I want to hear your thoughts again. The question here is, he's not leaving us in that place of despair. He's saying you can't give into despair. And then, of course, the very real question is, how do we do that? Or how do we go forward there? So let's look at this next piece together, the third text. Again, this is also a very famous Rabbi Nachman text. Mitzvah gedolah liyot besimcha tamid. It is a great mitzvah to be happy always. Just thinking back, hear the language of that first Torah. He says what he was using that word, same word tamid, always, to say a person is always full of suffering, right? And now he's saying, and yet, even though I've acknowledged that a person is always full of suffering, and think of his own suffering in his life, even though he's acknowledged that suffering, he's saying, and yet at the same time, mitzvah gedolah liyot besimcha tamid. It is a great mitzvah to be happy always. The question you should be thinking in your mind is, what does it mean? What does this mean? That's what I want to hear from you when we come back to the chat. What does it he mean when he says it's a great mitzvah to be happy always? What is he asking of us? What is being asked of ourselves? To overcome and to distance oneself from sadness and sort of this bitter blackness, the marash chora, with all of one's strength. The haklal, the rule, that one has to overcome and strengthen oneself with all of one's strength, liot ach samech tamid, so somehow to be always happy. Because it's the way of a person, it's the natural, our natural disposition is to draw oneself to this place of darkness and sadness. As a result of the things that happen to us, just sort of the natural things that happen as in a matter of time in our lives. The kol adam malei yisurim, and every person is full of suffering. Alken tzarich la'achriach et atzmo bekoach gadol. And so for that reason, because it's the way of a person naturally to sort of go towards this dark place, and we are all sort of so full of legitimate reasons to suffer, just things that happen in our lives, therefore a person has to force themselves with all of their strength to be happy, and to make oneself happy with whatever they have available to him in any way possible. I like this next line, but feel bemile shtuta, even with things of silliness. Sometimes this reminds me of you have to make yourself laugh even when you don't feel like laughing, because that generates something. You know, sometimes you have to sort of lean into it before you're fully there. I want to say, so someone had asked in the chat about Rabbi Nachman's emotional well-being. I think it has been said that Rabbi Nachman, I'm not an expert on Rabbi Nachman in terms of his psychological disposition, but people have written about it, and it has been written that perhaps Rabbi Nachman, I think that the depression he's talking about is a very real depression, and that it's also been said that perhaps he was bipolar or experienced manic depression in his life, that the sort of swings that he's talking about may have been actually, you know, a real clinical swings. And what I want to say about this is I read this piece as I think that there is sadness, and I think that there is clinical depression, real mental illness. And I don't think what this piece is saying, I want to say two things sort of as a caveat to this piece that I think is really important. One is, I don't think that this piece is saying, this piece is not talking to people who are experience, you know, God forbid, mental illness, clinical depression. It is not saying to them, just make yourself happy. You have an obligation to be happy. That is not something that we can say. Mental illness is a very real thing, and this would not be the way to respond to that. And the second thing that I want to say is, I don't read this. This is not pastoral advice that you give to someone else. For me, this is like pastoral advice that maybe I give to myself, that when I see in myself that I have a tendency to go towards sadness, I can say to myself, but how do I bring myself up? How do I make myself happy? This is not something that you ever say to someone else. When they come to you and they say, I'm experiencing deep depression, God forbid, or I'm experiencing deep sadness, that you say to them, you know what, don't worry, just be happy. This is not the advice you give to someone else, God forbid, that in that case, what we need to do is just be present with someone in their sadness, not try to talk them out of it. But for me, I feel like this is useful Torah to know when to sort of use with my own self to say, is there an opportunity here to pull myself out of my sadness, not to sort of deploy this on someone else? So I want to say that is a very important caveat. So he says, even though he says the way of a person is to be drawn towards sadness, but we have to make ourselves happy with whatever we can in whatever way we can. And then he goes on to say something very beautiful. He says, "Af shegam lev nishbar hu tov me'od," but also a broken heart is very good. "Im kol ze hu rak be'ezah sha'ah ve'ru'i likvo lo ezah sha'ah b'yom shaber libo u'lefaresh sichato lefanav yitbarach." He said, and even so, he says, on one hand, a broken heart is very important. Let's talk about what that means. What does he mean? A broken heart is very important, very good. He said that even though a broken heart is very good, has a very important place, only for an hour, only for a small period of time, he says a person should fix, should establish each day, an hour, a set amount of time, l'shaber libo, to break their heart and to spread their sort of conversation, to talk to God, the Holy One. I think that this is amazing. He's saying, on one hand, he says, you have to be happy always. And then he says, but actually it's balanced, because there's an important place for the lev nishbar, for the broken heart, but only so much. It can't take up your whole day. And at the same time, you have to set a time every day to have this broken hearted time. And he even uses the language of lishaber libo, to break your heart. It almost sounds like, and even if you thought, I don't need this broken hearted time, because I actually am somehow in this miracle place of being happy always, I don't need this time. He's saying, even so, you still need that hour. You still need that time that is set to break your own heart, to open yourself up, because we actually all need that, we all need this established place and time for sadness. So on the one hand, he's saying, you have to be happy always. On the other hand, he's saying there's actually a very important place for sadness, to such an extent that we need to make sure we build into our lives the space for processing that and for bringing that sadness to God. Not for keeping it inside ourselves, for going deep within, but for actually drawing that sadness out and finding a way to talk about it. He says, "Aval kol hayom kulo tzarich liyot b'simcha," but all of the day one needs to be in happiness. Because from a place of brokenheartedness, one can easily go to this sort of bitter, dark place. More than a person can stumble as a result of happiness, to come to some sort of frivolity, he says, God forbid. Because just getting to this dark place is much more likely to come when you are too long in this place of brokenheartedness. Just one last line here. Al ken tzarich shiyeh b'simcha tamid. And so for this reason, a person has to be in a place of happiness always. Rak b'sha'a miyuchedet yeh lo lev nishbar. And just for this specific time should a person be in this place of brokenheartedness. Okay, I want to pause now. I'm going to stop screen sharing. And I want to hear, How do you understand this? On the one hand, Rabbi Nachman is giving us such important Torah of legitimizing our own feelings of pain and suffering, of saying that this is the one thing that is universal. On the other hand, he's saying, nevertheless, we have to be happy always. How do you understand that commandment? How do you understand that from Rabbi Nachman? How do you understand that yourself? So Chana says, reminds me of the Dalai Lama's art of happiness. Suffering and heartbreak are existential conditions. The Dalai Lama's way is through compassion for others, where Rabbi Nachman seems to suggest that the state of happiness is its own goal, as if the state of joy is a holy condition. Yeah, and I want to also connect this and go to Kathy's comment. So the translation, you're right, Kathy, it's very important. Lev nishbar, here in the translation, I haven't done the translation. This translation is contrition, as if we've done something wrong, which feels very different than brokenhearted. I'm not sure how to speak to that. You also notice that in the language, he says that a person lashuv ve'lachzor, that a person has to, you know, one way of, you could translate that as lashuv is another word for return, to return and to return to God. But of course, lashuv has the connotation of tshuva, as though I've done something wrong and I'm atoning. The way that I understand that for myself is that it's talking about that sometimes when we get into that place of darkness, it takes us to a place of doubt. Of doubting God and doubting the people in our lives and sort of doubting, you know, doubting even the existence of the world. And that there's a sense from that place of distance that it takes us. We not only have to return from that distance, but there's a sense of, like, I guess, atoning for being in that place of distance. But I'm sort of more comfortable personally with the translation of Ledni Spar, of the broken hardness, than in, you know, I've done something wrong and I'm being punished for it and now I'm returning. But in the sense of that, when we are in that dark place, it makes us distant from the people that love us and also from God. And so we need to return from that. Sarah says, in my own experience, when I'm calling out a period of depression, it does feel like returning to that life, that Lishuv and Velachzor, which is thinking about Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur and sort of the experience of life or death, feels very relevant. Hilda says, searching for something positive, good in yourself and others that is good, that you are grateful for, that you can focus on to be happy. Hilda, which is exactly what the larger context of this Torah is here, is that he's talking about, in the previous Torah, he's talking about not despairing, to always find the good in others and always find the good in yourself, that it's so easy to lose track of it. And so part of what it means to be happy is, he says, just start out with that small spark, just start out with the one point. And I think that feels very key here, that I think when I think of what it means to be happy, it sounds to me like flick a switch, be happy, be fully happy 100%, as if happiness is sort of a state we can just jump to. And I think that can't be what he's saying, because he's already acknowledging for us sort of the suffering we live with. That I think for me, what I take from this is that you might think that happiness is just you flick a switch, but actually happiness is a striving. And it's a process. And sometimes that process starts with just finding that one nikuda, that one point of good in yourself or in someone else that can bring you back. Sometimes striving towards happiness means like just waking up in the morning. Sometimes the most we can do is just open our eyes. Sometimes the most we can do is just get dressed. Sometimes we can call a friend and say we need help. Sometimes perhaps it's prayer, as Michael was suggesting. But that I think the key here is, on one hand, he's saying we have to, it's a commandment to be happy, but that happiness is not a state that we just jump to. It's a striving in whatever way we are able to in that moment. Yeah, Sarah.
I am very uncomfortable with how he discounts the depression part. Because in my own experience, which is, of course, the only thing I can speak to, I have seen these periods as actually, I get a lot out of them when I get out of them. And in some ways, I have now recognized when I feel one coming on, that it's my soul saying, you need to do some heshbon nefesh, like no matter what time of year it is. Like there's just like overload, even if it's all good. Like you need to withdraw and just settle yourself somehow and then come back and go on. So I think that for me, they've not in the moment, but over the long haul have contributed much to my life.
Which I think that's honestly, that's what I hear him saying as well. I mean, that's part of that he's saying. On one hand, he could have stopped there and said, you should just be happy all the time, but he doesn't say that. He says, actually, the lev nishbar is really important. And that's what I hear you saying too, that brokenheartedness, is that sometimes you need that period. And sometimes you might not even think you need that period, but you still have to actively break your own heart open to create that space, because it is through that sadness, it is through that darkness that you actually come to this deeper place of growth, as you're suggesting. So I don't see him, I see him cautioning against going so deep into it that we're not able to pull ourselves out of it. But I think he also thinks that place is really important and necessary. I think the caution there is to spread our conversation before God. I think the caution there is, when we go into that darkness, and this is so hard, and again, I'm really distinguishing between sort of clinical depression and sadness, when we go into that place and it just goes inward, 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 he's trying to caution us about keeping us in that place, but keeping it out, giving it to God or giving it to other people. Paul.
I think part of it being a mitzvah and a commandment is that you have an obligation to the people around you to be happy, especially the people you have a lot of influence over, like your children or your spouse. And it's an obligation. It's an obligation to the people around you to get that happiness and to be that way.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul. Okay, I want to look at one more piece with you together. He offers this something beautiful. He says, Binyan Hasimcha, talking about happiness on the matter of happiness. I'll read a little bit in the English and then I'm going to switch back to the Hebrew. He says, an analogy. Sometimes when people are happy and dance, they grab someone outside the circle who is depressed and gloomy. And against his will, they bring him into the circle of dancers. Against his will, they force him to be happy along with them. So he's thinking about a wedding simcha. He says, sometimes at a wedding, there are the people who are dancing, right? There's always the people who are in the circle that are the first to go. And then there's the people on the outside who are like, you know, he says depressed and gloomy, but who are more reticent, who don't sort of jump to that simcha dancing. And he says, sometimes the way that it goes with happiness is it's the people on the inside, the people who are so happy, who bring the other people sort of force. They seem like they don't want to dance. They force them into the circle. And then everyone is in the festivities. He says, Ken yesh binyan simcha, and so too it is with the matter of happiness. Kisha adam sameach, azai hamarash chora b'yisurim nistalkim minatzad. He says, when a person is happy, the darkness and the suffering sort of slink off. They go to the side. Aval mala yitera li'damet lirdof achar marash chora dafka. But actually it would be a greater thing, a greater striving to actually pursue the darkness. Specifically, here's that word dafka or daika, that actually we think that when we're happy, what should happen is we're happy. And so we push, really, you know, he says nistalkin in the passive, that the darkness, the suffering sort of slide off to the side when you're happy. But it's almost like when we're happy, we push that sadness. We push the darkness to the side. And he says, that's actually not the way that it should be. He said, actually, the mala yitira, the better thing would be to have the courage to go after, to actively pursue that darkness, to pursue it, lechnisota gam ken betoch ha-simcha, and to bring it into inside of our happiness. Be'ofen sha morash chora be'atzma titapech le-simcha, because it's in this way that that darkness can turn into happiness. We think that when we're happy, we think that perhaps the healthy thing to do is to push off our gloominess, to push off our sadness. And he says, no, the braver thing to do is to have the courage to go after the darkness, to look it in the eye, to hold it, to acknowledge it, and then to invite it in the happiness, because that is the only way there's a chance that you can actually transform that marash chora, that darkness, into happiness. Otherwise, it's just going to always stay there on the side waiting. She'apecha marash chora, so that darkness and all the suffering will switch to happiness. It's sort of in the way of coming into happiness. That in this way, because of the greatness of the happiness, that all the worries and the sadness and the darkness will turn to happiness. Nimtza shechotef hamorash chora umachnis ota ba'al korcha letoch simcha. And so, and this only happens when a person grabs the darkness and brings it against its will into the happiness. And I think I want to pause there on this text to say that for me, you know, sort of going, the whole thing, I think, with the Rebbe Nachman is holding the tension that on one hand, naming the suffering, on the other hand, saying that we have to be happy always. And I think for me here, I hear this in the same place of the Lev Nishbar, the place of the brokenhearted, that he's saying, you might think that really what we should be striving to do is to be happy always and to just stay in the place of happiness. But actually the thing that requires more courage, the thing that's so important to do is to not leave your sadness by the sidelines, but you actually have to invite your sadness in. Because if you don't invite your sadness in, if you don't take that risk of being with your sadness for whatever that period of time is, it's always just going to stay there waiting. You're never going to be able to transform it. The only way you can actually transform sadness into joy is by taking the risk of holding that sadness and bringing it in. And only then will it be able to be transformed into happiness. Yeah, Rebecca.
That last point is almost about like depression can make you really, like, part of it is like hating yourself and hating the depression. It's almost like kind of loving yourself and even kind of like being kind to yourself and your depression. I'm not sure if I got the word right, but
yeah, I appreciate that, because I think part of what he's pointing to is a way in which depression and sadness can be so isolating. I hear that both in the previous text where he says you need that period of lev nishbar, not to be just in the brokenheartedness, but to spread that, to bring that conversation to God. I think part of that is not letting yourself be isolated in it. And I think also here too, that there's a sense in which like, just let the depression be on the sideline, of like pushing those parts of yourself away, or I hear in that sort of the hating those parts of yourselves. And at least what I want to read in this text is like, no, you actually have to invite those parts in. You have to hold those parts of yourself. It's only if you hold them that you're going to be able to transform them in any way.
One of the things, I don't know much about Rabbi Nachman, but I love it because it reminds me of why his stories are used. I mean, I'm an attorney, but I'm fascinated by the Jung theory and archetypes. And it reminds me of why the stories are used, because in essence, you're integrating the sadness and the happiness. You're balancing them out to become more full. Because like you said, if you push one of them aside, you're not really living life to its fullest, because life consists of both good and bad, darkness and light, you know, happy and sad. So I like the way that he integrates it. And it's funny that he possibly was, depressed and he was manic, but he's actually talking about something that many therapists will use in terms of trying to help people, in terms of accepting both sides of yourself to be more full and to be, you know, to be more complete. So I'm fascinated by his stories.
Thank you. Yeah, Hilda, I appreciate that. Rabbi Lapadin, I see your very challenging and important question. It's so hard to answer. I wish you would speak to it yourself. He says, can you give an example of taking the sad thing and making it part of the simcha? And he's giving examples of sad things, COVID, racism in our society. I don't know. I have a hesitation to your question, because part of this is the caution of, you find the good in every bad. And I think my caution there is moving sort of too quickly, neutralizing the bad, of saying like, you know, God forbid that in all suffering this is a thing that people do, but in all suffering to say like, oh, but there's always the silver lining, or this will also be for good. And I'm hesitant to do that, especially when it's about other people's pain. I can manage to do that in my own personal pain. I feel like that's a goal, but I'm hesitant to like, other people are experiencing hardship, and to say for them, don't worry, I found the good for you. I think it's hard with COVID and racism because they feel societal and I don't want to neutralize other people's suffering. I guess I can speak to myself and say, I'm thinking about, you know, this experience of COVID right now, which in many ways, you know, also we're so blessed in the way that we are experiencing this. You know, so far everyone in our life is healthy and jobs are fine and all of that. But it has been there's been a lot of sadness. So, you know, we have kids that haven't socialized with other kids in 6 months, and that feels like a really hard thing. I don't know. I think part of the happiness for us is like we're creating weekly rituals. We have a Sunday morning chocolate chip pancake breakfast that I feel like is my lifeline, of like knowing that there's a ritual every Sunday that gives me happiness. And that happiness, the chocolate chip pancake breakfast, sort of spreads into the rest of the week of something to look forward to, or, you know, trying to like appreciate. We've been spending a lot of time, there's like a nature reserve by us that we were never going to before, of like having that bit of happiness. But again, I just really want to caution. I think it's something that's important to do in our own lives, of bringing the sadness into the happiness. Again, I also think you see this in Judaism. Right? Judaism is like, we stand in the chuppah and we break the glass. This is not a novel idea. We break the glass to remember the loss of the temple, to remember the pain and suffering still in this world. That's a very concrete example of bringing the sadness into the greatest moments of happiness and then allowing that to be transformed. But it's a great question. I want to take a minute at the end here to go back to how we began at the beginning, that really what Rabbi Nachman wanted us to do was to take his Torah and to not keep it on the intellectual level, to deeply internalize it, to sit with it, and to hopefully make it into a prayer for ourselves. And so I actually want to take a moment. We're going to take a moment in quiet. And I just want you to think about some, we've covered a lot of text today. to think of something that you want to take with you, some idea, some line, some concept, and what would be the prayer? What would be the prayer that you would articulate from this that you want to take with you going into Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, remembering that we're going into this period of hope and possibility and growth and joy? What's your prayer for yourself? So we'll take a pause there. So as you continue thinking about your own prayers, I just want to say this is very real personal material to dive into as a new group together. And so I'm grateful to be invited into your learning. And I'm grateful for the way that you just dove into this topic. And second, my prayer for myself and my prayer for us comes from that last line that we should have the courage to actually go after the darkness. That sometimes we think we need to push it aside, that we should have the courage to go after the darkness, to hold the sadness, and also to have the fortune to transform it into happiness, to transform it into hope.